Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2018. This one is with Blackpilled, Devin Stack from the Blackpilled YouTube channel. So, hello. Should I address you as Devin? How should I address you?
You can call me that Dr. Stack if you would like. You can call me Devin.
Devin.
No, it's kind of funny. People always call me Blackpilled, like that's my name, and then I get it.
It's the
But
same.
that's fine. Either or.
Okay, I'll call you BP. How about that? So,
British Petroleum.
just to tell people about the channel and when you started it, and it's a big channel. I mean, it's like over 100,000. So but it was weird because I only discovered it a few months ago, and I thought, how the hell did I never know about this before? You did an excellent, we spoke about it before a few months ago. You did a really good review of a film called Norma Rae, which I'd also never heard of before, by the way. And but it was one of these sort of seminal, one of those films that our parents would have known. They would have watched it when they were young. And
Up your
but
path
for me, it had
there.
fallen by the wayside. Sorry?
Make sure just get better for now.
Oh, you went robotic there. I didn't catch any of that. Can you say something else? No, I'm not hearing anything at all.
Still here, but I did
Ah, there
not
you
hear
are. Okay.
anything.
All right. Okay. Yeah. There was
Oh,
a
I heard
connection.
something.
Right. There was a connection problem there. So I'll just take it over to you and tell people about your channel, because that was how I discovered it. This very good film review, but there are other good videos as well that I watched. So it's a very interesting channel. So tell people about the history of it.
Well, I would say the movie stuff, a lot of my background is in film, and I worked in the film industry, and I worked in television news for a long time, and I've always had an interest in film and storytelling and propaganda, quite frankly. And I don't think a lot of people have a good I don't think they have a good understanding of just how much they're being propagandized in films. I always One thing I got frustrated with a lot is a lot of people who I considered, woke or based or whatever. You'd talk to them about movies and they'd be like, "Oh yeah, my favorite movies." And they tell you some like the most culturally Marxist film in the world. And it would infuriate me, and I would try to explain to them, "No, like don't you understand that movie was basically telling you that white people are bad and that we should feel bad and that, we should basically kill ourselves." I mean, there's in some movies it's that direct. In fact, there's a movie right now I'm working on a review on that's basically that. That's basically it's the most anti-white film that I've probably in terms of like people not like if you just watch it you might not get that. In fact, I watched this movie when I was a kid and I didn't get that. But it's sincerely the most anti-white film that might even exist. It's because there's storytelling devices that people will use on the screen that'll go right into your head, and it's really subliminal. You might be so wrapped up in the visuals, or you're so wrapped up in the emotional part of the storytelling that you really don't see the programming that's going into your head. So I like to just kind of dissect the films and point out, and not just films, but also with media and do other videos too. It's not always like, "Oh, I'm going to review a movie." In fact, I started doing that because the news was depressing me so much that I didn't want to do a video about the news. So I just did a video about a movie that I had watched recently. I was like, "You know what? Screw the news."
I'll just point out that I've switched off my camera because I think that there were bandwidth issues earlier
Yeah,
on,
I
so I'm
think
going to
so too,
avoid
but
that.
it's working, seems to be working good now. I can hear you
Right.
fine.
Okay, good. So yeah, what you say about the propaganda in films, I mean, and how you don't notice it, it is absolutely true, because I could easily imagine watching Norma Rae, for example, and just have I could come out of it having no idea of what just happened to me. You know, that I've
Right.
like, obviously nowadays I'm more aware of things, or I hope I am. But I can easily imagine a normal mainstream audience watching that, absorbing the subtextual messages, and not even realizing.
Right.
Not even realizing that they had been persuaded of something, subtly, unconsciously persuaded of something. It's amazing, really, when you consider the power that is wielded by, any storyteller.
Yeah, and there's other things. I mean, there's a lot of channels, and just if you haven't seen any of the videos I've done, I'm not one of those channels, because there's channels that are like, oh, if you look at the back wall here, there's a star, and that star is a satanic star, and that symbolizes, you know, I'm not talking about stuff like that. You know, it's not even that subtle. But when you are younger, I mean, that stuff will just go right into your head. You don't even notice. You don't notice the different characters when they do their backstories. You know, like you learn like the origin story of a different of each character and the meaning that has. And you like for well, Norma Rae, for example. Norma Rae, if you watched that and you weren't thinking about anything and you weren't thinking about the identity of any of the characters, you just thought of them as just, as Americans tend to do, by the way, in a multicultural world, we just tend to look at people as people. And if you just look at it as people being people, a lot of that stuff might just go in one ear and out the other. But if you pay attention to the fact that and this might be weird because a lot of people probably haven't seen this movie because it was made in, I think, 1977. But, excuse me, the protagonist is a Jew from New York. He's a wealthy, educated guy, union guy. He works for the unions, and he's going to textile mills somewhere in the South. I don't know if they really specify. And so you have these, like, white Southerners, and they're portrayed as kind of like the way that Hollywood always portrays white Southerners, is just, you know, hicks, just backwoods, stupid people. And he goes there and he tries to get them to unionize, and the factory owners are these, you know, really bad people who need to stop the union from happening. And Norma Rae, the woman that the movie's named after, is falls in love with this guy that's trying to unionize the town, and then they have they don't have like an actual relationship, but they have a working relationship, and then he leaves after they get the union to work, and then that's the end. And you might watch that and think, okay, well, obviously the leftist message is, you know, unions are good. And it's like, well, that's part of it, and it's certainly part of it, but there's a lot of minutia in there that if you're paying attention, you'll pick up on. For example, one of the things that was necessary for her to really focus on working for the union was she had to go and break ties with the Christian church that she grew up going to. So there's this scene, and it's just a real quick scene, but it's death by a thousand cuts with these films a lot of times. So there's this scene where she talks to her preacher, and she's like, if you don't let this guy from New York come and talk and try to, you know, promote the union inside this church, then you're against the people of this town, and I don't want any part of this church anymore. And the preacher's like, all right, well then, you know, basically tells you to fuck off. And she's like, all right, this is no longer my religion. And so you're like, okay, so what's your religion now then? Leftism, which, you know, that's the assumption. And then the other part of it is they portray everyone in the town is racist. Her husband, for example, comes home and she's brought some black people from the factory to do a meeting in their living room or something. And he like freaks out. He's like, I can't believe you brought black people to come to our home. What are the neighbors going to say? And he's like this total, you know, caricature of a hick. And it's just, it's on and on and on. And then there's like even more subtle things in the beginning when you're first learning about this guy that's coming to unionize the town. And I mentioned he's Jewish, and that's because he keeps mentioning that he's Jewish. And it's in ways that's very kind of like in a very superior manner. Like it's a very condescending manner. And one of those ways is they compare, like, so he's unpacking. And well, just the circumstances that he meets Norma, the fact that she's out sleeping that's the other thing. So she's out sleeping with some married guy who beats her. It's like very white trash. Like every white person in this town is very white, you know, Jerry Springer white trash. And so he meets her and he's nice door lets her into the room and or the hotel room that he's staying at. And he just casually mentions, oh yeah, this is my girlfriend back, you know, in New York, and she's a lawyer, and, you know, she graduated from Harvard, or I don't remember if it was Harvard, but, you know, some Ivy League school. And he's clearly, you know, basically contrasting the woman that's good enough for him, you know, with Norma. And Norma even says at one point in this first exchange that they're having, you know, you say you're Jewish, but you really don't look any different than I do. I mean, you look like the same as, you know, you look like a white person, essentially. And he responds by saying, well, you know, we are different. And she's like, well, how are you different? And he just gets real smug and he's like, history. And it's like, if you're not, it's very like, what the hell is that supposed to mean? And so it's the kind of thing where it's, they make it an issue, you know? And I remember when I watched this, I mean, I didn't watch this. I mean, when it came out, I'm not alive yet. I watched this because I was going through and watching, it won the Oscar for Best Picture. That's the other thing too, is I try to only review movies that have won either Best Picture or was at least nominated for Best Picture. Cause people will accuse you of, oh, you picked some obscure movie. That's not, you know, representative of the culture or Hollywood. And it's like, no, this got Best Picture. And in fact, Norma Rae got the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival too. So like, it was like the movie of 1978 or might've been 77, but right in there. And the fact that a movie that essentially is about this very superior seeming New York wealthy educated Jewish guy coming down to teach the stupid white people, you know, how to behave and function. And then the end is very, I don't know. It reminds me of like, there's that very unpopular on YouTube interview of, and I don't know the name. You're gonna know what I'm talking about though. There's the interview with the very elite Jewish guys talking about the immigration crisis in Europe and how it's no longer safe.
Should the Jews leave Europe? Yeah,
right.
I've watched that quite a few times. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of like I was reminded of that because at the end of Norma Rae, so after at the very, very end of the movie, it ends with the factory is unionized. He's defeated the evil, you know, white factory owners who are all basically just evil white racists. And Norma Rae, she's out of a job and she kind of wants to cheat on her husband with this guy. And she's just really fawning over him. And he just packs up. He's like, all right, cool. Well, I got you guys unionized. Laters, and just leaves. And someone commented on the video, like, and now all those factories are in China.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And it's true. Yeah.
That's an interesting sort of postscript to it, isn't it? But, I mean, the other part of it is, and I'll emphasize I haven't seen the film, but from what you've said, this guy at the end is leaving her. She's basically in love with him. And he, at any rate, he's completely disrupted her life. And he's leaving her without her religion, without her job, and with a shaky relationship with her husband.
Right.
And she's probably fallen out with God knows how many people in the town. So she's not in a good way when he's completely, well, I don't know.
He comes out of nowhere. He turns her life and her town upside down, remakes it in his image, and then leaves to go to the next town to do the same thing. That's where he's going. When he leaves, he's like, all right, well, I'm off to go do, you know, go to my next assignment. And so he's just literally going from town to town and just, you know, remaking it how he thinks it should be. And with no regard whatsoever for the existing culture. So
But another, like one of the most interesting things, fascinating things in the video that you made, it really made me think, was when you said that there is no moment in this film. You said that with these kinds of films, usually there's a moment when the person has been, like, they've been parachuted into a deprived neighborhood of some kind, whether it's a working class like hick town, or it's a black ghetto, or something like that, a Chinese ghetto, or whatever it is, something like that. So this privileged person is parachuted in there, and they go in and teach the locals something. But there's always a moment in these films where the person themselves is taught something. But in this film, right, there is no such moment. There is no moment where, I think it is his name, Ruben, where he is taught something. It's sort of like he is perfect, and there is nothing for him to learn. There is nothing for him to be taught by these ignorant white redneck idiots. They're just cattle.
Right. No, like, in the 90s, there's a ton, and everyone listening probably knows what I'm talking about. There's like a ton of movies where, some upper class white chick, you know, goes to the ghetto and she teaches the black kids something, like, you know, how to behave or whatever. But there's always, it's a trade-off. It's not like she shows up and she's like, I'm so much better than all you ghetto kids, and I'm going to show you how to behave. It's like she shows them how to have discipline, and they show her like how to have fun, or like be in touch with like some part of her there's always, it's a trade-off. It's always like, oh, she learned something about herself, and they learned how to, like, you know, graduate from high school or whatever, but it's always a trade-off. And with this movie, every time anyone tries to teach Ruben or share something like that's a part of their culture, he rejects it. In fact, like, there's several instances he shows up to a baseball game and he's talking shit about, like, one of the first times you meet this guy, he shows up to a local baseball game, he's talking shit about the baseball game, he goes to get a hot dog, takes a bite, literally spits it out, and then it's just like, oh, I can't eat this. He talks shit about the food in the town. Like, he never stops complaining about how nothing's good enough for him.
Criticizing.
Right. The entire time. And anytime there's any kind of pushback, he always shuts it down. And it's like he can do no wrong. And the one thing that really struck me is, because I was expecting, having not seen it, I was expecting there to be an affair that happens in this movie. And if it was realistic, that's what it would have happened.
He even rejects her, though. That's right. I mean, from what you're saying, it's like even she.
They go skinny dipping. They go skinny dipping. This guy's girlfriend is like 1,000 miles away in New York or whatever, and they've been working side by side. She's obviously, you know, attractive, and it's like he doesn't even notice. He's just so, you know, stoic. And it's just like, why would he even consider making out with this bumpkin, you know, that's so beneath him? And so it was the fact that this movie existed wasn't that weird to me. And obviously you can, it's not that hard to guess that it was written by, you know, a Jewish writer and directed by a Jewish director, Jewish producers, and, you know, the guy who played Ruben is, you know, obviously Jewish. And so that wasn't surprising to have a movie like that. But what was surprising was that it won the top prize at Cannes, and it won Best Picture, and I think Sally Field got her, that was when she got her Oscar for Best Actress even. So, I mean, I think this racked up, I'd have to look it up, but I think this racked up quite a few Oscars. And so this was like a big, big movie. And, you know, it's really not that great of a movie. You know, like, it'd be one thing if it had all the shit that I kind of had a problem with culturally, but then there was like some aspect of it that was really amazing, you know, like, oh, well, you know, her performance was so great, I could see why, but it didn't really seem like that outstanding of a film to me. And even for the 70s is famous for just having really bad movies. I don't know what happened. Like, I really don't know what happened. But there's this weird era between like the 60s films and then like Star Wars, where almost every movie is terrible. Like, I don't know what happened. It's like, actually, what I suspect happened is it was a changing of, I'm being serious here too. I think it was a changing of the guard. It was when old Hollywood was retiring and the baby boomers were getting the chance to like be the directors and stuff, you know? And the baby boomers had been so coddled their entire lives, and they just didn't have discipline or, quite frankly, apparently talent in filmmaking. So they made all these just horrific, you know, over the top, gratuitous films because that was just kind of like their thing. And they didn't really catch a rhythm until like Star Wars or something. Like, I don't know what the deal was, but there is like this black hole of good movies that occurs right in the 70s era. But yeah, I mean, so maybe that was the thing, is like this movie came out and just everything else was so terrible. But it's just weird. It's a weird movie to have so many awards when it's so clearly, it's not even a subtext. It's very clearly a movie about Jewish identity, or New York Jewish identity, if you want to be more specific, encountering Southern white identity and basically just dominating the shit out of it and changing it and, you know, remaking it and then leaving.
Yeah, and having nothing to learn from it whatsoever. That's the thing that fascinates me the most.
Right.
There is no need for self-reflection on the part of the New York Jew. He's just an infallible creature. I find that fascinating. I can only keep using that word.
Yeah, no, there literally is never a point where he is ever criticized, ever. Like, not even a tiny bit. So it's, which is a rare thing, you know, for a character. Usually there's every character has a flaw, right? And
yeah, there's character development.
Yeah, there is no development. He doesn't have a story arc. He has zero story arc. He just shows up and he's exactly the same when he leaves, you know? And you know, technically you could say it's because Norma Rae is the main character and she's the one that's overcoming the change, but the change is kind of awful because when he shows up, she's really not that much better off when he leaves. In fact, we could argue that she's worse off. She's literally the credits start rolling while she's standing in the middle of the street all alone, longingly looking at his car as drives away, you know? And like you said, without a job, rocky relationship with her husband, and
religion.
Yeah, and no religion, and probably a lot of enemies in town. So it's kind of like he just shows up, and devastates everything and leaves. And they gave it
with Ruben,
you know,
with
best Ruben pictures.
they gave it. It's pretty bad.
So, that's the sort of thing you see a lot. Like, it's not every single movie has a left-wing bias, but almost every single movie has a leftist bias for sure. And a message they're trying to drill into your head. This one was just very explicit.
yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, I think we've gone on about Norma Rae much longer than I expected to, but that was because that was the video by which I discovered your channel. So what I'd like to ask is, first of all, I haven't watched your two recent videos, your two most recent videos, but people in the chat are saying that it seems to, these two recent ones seem to signal a new direction for you. Before we get to that, let's talk about the channel itself. So what did you want to achieve with it? Or were you thinking in those terms at all when you started it?
Honestly, when I first started the channel, I started it to make sure Hillary didn't get elected. I wasn't super excited about Trump, but he wasn't Hillary, and I thought he had a real good chance. If anyone had a chance, he was gonna be the one that would beat Hillary. He was good on some of the things. I just didn't know if he was going to actually follow through. And as we've seen, there's a lot of things that he hasn't followed through on. And you could say maybe yet, maybe he will. But I'm more anti-left than I am pro-Trump. You know what I mean? So I could not imagine surviving, this country surviving another 4 years of a Marxist in office. And that's what Obama was. I'm surprised in some ways that we survived 8 years of Obama. And I knew we wouldn't survive another 4 years of Hillary. Part of me kind of, you know, in some time, there's sometimes, it really depends on how, what Trump does. But there are some times where I kind of wonder if maybe it would have been better if Hillary won, only because it would, I feel like we have two futures. We have two possible futures. We have the slow death, where we're just circling the drain until eventually, you know, we're communists, or we have the violent stop of the pendulum's movement and it returning the other direction. And I kind of like, if you look at history, you know, I think those are the only two options. And I don't want to live in a world where we're just slowly like circling the drain and everything's just getting slowly worse until I die. I don't want that. I would much rather have to live through a less peaceful resolution to our situation. And you know, not that I definitely don't want violence. You know, I'm not one of these people that's like, hoorah, let's do this. You know, nothing like that. I'm not looking forward to anything like that. It just, you know, if you look at history, there's only two different ways I think this can go. And I thought Trump was kind of a wild card that might steer us in a third direction. But I haven't seen it. You know, I haven't seen, like, because he had... And I know he's not a dictator, right? Like, I know he's got limits to what he can do. But he has the kind of support where, quite frankly, and Obama would just sign. Like, Obama didn't give a shit about the Constitution. And Obama would just do executive orders and get what he wanted to get done. And the Republicans wouldn't push back on it because they were afraid of, I don't know, either they were afraid of being called racist or they were in on it, honestly. There's no... Either way, nothing got pushed back on him. Like the whole DACA in the first place was, that's not constitutional, but they let him do it. So if Trump were to behave in the same way, he's got the public support. You know, he's got the public support to do it. The media would flip out, whatever. Who cares? They already flip out. They flip out when he does nothing. So there's a lot of things that Trump could do while not strictly adhering to the Constitution, and I wouldn't care, quite frankly. And I was a libertarian before this, and I'm still am to some degree, but at a certain point, you know, someone's got to take the bull by the horns and just take control. And I was kind of hoping that Trump would be that guy, and that remains to be seen. I'm not seeing it right now. There's a lot of things that for sure he could take action on, and that either there's some, as the you know, the QAnon people think, there's either some crazy big plan that is in the works that eventually we're going to see some action on, or it's not going to happen, and we basically have you know, Jeb Trump, because the guy he picked, Kavanaugh, is literally exactly who Jeb Bush would have picked. I mean, Kavanaugh was George Bush's lawyer. I mean, he was with him on 9/11, and he helped write the Patriot Act. This guy isn't like, you know, he's not our guy. And so when everyone was like, oh yeah, Kavanaugh's owning the libs, he's making girls cry, and he's like a bro and throws parties and drinks beer. It's like, yeah, he's literally he is a bro. He's like a George W. Bush, you know, frat boy kind of bro, like a globalist bro. He's not the kind of guy that we want on the Supreme Court, but hey, whatever. I mean, is it better than who Hillary would have picked? Sure. I mean, that's the big downside if Hillary would have won, I guess, is that she'd be picking all these Supreme Court justices. And yeah, you know, he's better than anyone she would have picked, because she would have picked, another RBG. or RGB. And, or no, I got it right the first time, RBG. And, so there's things like that where you see he doesn't really do anything that is really substantively different than what a Jeb Bush would have done, or, you know, any of the other guys that were running. So I mean, there's no swamp being drained. There isn't. I mean, the only Cohen, his lawyer, he got 3 years in prison today. So the only part of the swamp that got drained was the guy who was working for him as his lawyer. So, you know, that's not really helping out, or, you know, that's not really draining the swamp. And then build the wall. There's no wall. There's no wall. There's just as much wall as there would have been if Jeb got elected. And people say, oh, well, you know, the Democrats, they're blocking it. Well, guess what? You know, the Democrats couldn't block it the first 2 years when he had the House and the Senate. And, you know, Obama got done his first 2 years when he had the House and the Senate. He got Obamacare passed. And we're stuck with a being alive tax now. Well, I mean, I guess they got rid of the mandate. But, you know, they had a being alive tax passed. Where you just had a tax. If you're alive, if you're an American and you're alive, you have a tax now that you have to pay, you know, the Obamacare tax. And, you know, whether you had insurance or not, you just had to pay the tax. And so that's what Obama got done in his first 2 years. And so it's kind of like, what did we get? We got tax cuts for the rich. I mean, and I hate using it that way, you know, using that phrase, because that's, you know, sounds very leftist of me. But is it really wrong? I don't think it is. You know, like they were talking about, oh, this company, they just donated all $10 million that they got from the Trump tax cut. And I was like, why the fuck did this leftist company get a $10 million tax cut? You know what I mean? That tells you where it's going. And the economy is not exactly, I mean, we're not on the strongest footing right now. Trump, the candidate, was talking about how, oh, it's a bubble, it's about to burst, it's a bubble. And then he gets elected and he's like, woo, the stock market, it's never been better. And you look at the data, I mean, I'm not an economist, so I could just totally be wrong, but just from what I've read and what I've seen, it does look like we're about to have another bubble, like an everything bubble. And I don't, you know, like the housing market is screwed because you have, you know, people from our generation can't afford housing. You know, I can't afford housing. And, you have all these boomers that are going to be dying off all at the same time. And, you'll have a bunch of houses that will finally hit the market with no one to buy them. And, there's a lot of economic factors that aren't looking too awesome. Plus, I've thought this. I think we're well due for another .com bubble. I mean, you think about it this way: Twitter has been around for, I don't know, like 10 years, and it's never turned a profit ever. It has literally never turned a profit. And same thing with, so Google, out of every product that Google owns, so that's, you know, YouTube, well, I guess they got rid of Plus. I mean, they keep buying products and then they run them into the ground. But out of every product that Google owns, the only product that makes money is Google search. Everything else bleeds money. And so same thing with a lot of, like, I think Snapchat's been bleeding money since its inception. So you have all these huge giants that have never turned a profit, and they're just getting money pumped into them. And I'm sure a lot of that's funded because that data is useful to people that are pumping money into them. And the influence is useful to the people pumping money into them. But I kind of feel like there could be a huge collapse, especially with a lot of these companies, if they have mass exoduses. You know, like you had Sargon get shit canned from Patreon. And I actually had quite a few Patreon or patrons message me and say, hey, we're leaving this platform. And I don't blame them, you know, that we're leaving this platform. We're going to go to another one. And they went to Subscribestar, and I set up a page on there today. And so you're going to have a lot of people fleeing these platforms as they get deplatformed. And let's face it, I think that in terms of content, I mean, if YouTube were to get rid of everyone they really wanted to get rid of on ideological or for ideological reasons, they would, I mean, how much money would they, I mean, YouTube already doesn't make money. How much money would they lose from that? The exciting, cool stuff on YouTube are people on the right. You know, they did that YouTube rewind video that became the second most, and maybe it's the first now, but it became the second most disliked video of all time on YouTube because it featured all these, you know, safe PC SJW YouTubers that everyone fucking hates. And if left to their own devices, I mean, if they really got to curate their platforms the way they wanted to, it would just become some horrible, everything would turn into Tumblr. It would just, no one would want to use it. So I don't know. I feel like there's just a lot of,
well, what you were moving on to saying is that there's going to be an economic crisis coming because of all the internet corporations, another .com crisis.
Right. No, and I think that could happen. And if that happens, yeah. So, all right. So here's the thing. we're in this tricky position to where I honestly, like I said, I'm not a warmonger. I don't want to be in a position where, I don't want to be put in the same position that Americans were put into, during the first Civil War, where you had brother fighting brother and just, you know, awful, awful loss of life. And, it would be even worse now given the way that the weapons, I mean, you have something like 100 million, or maybe it's more than that, but over 100 million gun owners in America. You've got weapons that are not just muskets anymore. And you have some people that are itchy. You know, they got itchy trigger finger there, and they've been preparing for something, and they really want to get the party started. I'm not like that. I think it's really good to be prepared, because I do think it's a very good possibility that's the way it goes. And so I think it'd be crazy to not be prepared and to not, you know, be ready for a situation like that. But it's not something I'm looking forward to. And it's really dicey even talking about it, you know, especially on, you know, like on a platform like this, because then people say, oh, you know, you're promoting violence and that sort of thing. And that's not what I'm doing. I see it as I don't want to say it's inevitable, but I think it's like really close to inevitable. And especially if, you know, we don't see something miraculous come out of the Trump administration, and it's not looking that way. And it's something that we do need to sort of start talking about, at least in terms of, hey, how do we avoid this? You know, because that's the way I see it going. And that's actually, by the way, that's one of the reasons I wrote my book. I'm going to plug my book, Day of the Rope. You can get it on Amazon, at least for right now. Day of the Rope by Devin Stack. It's got a lot of good reviews, but that's one of the things I wrote because it's a subject you can only really talk about in the context of fiction, because you start talking about this in any kind of real world, framing, and instantly they're like, oh, you're trying to, you know, promote war, promote violence. Like Alex Jones got totally permabanned from Twitter for saying something that was totally obviously a metaphor, you know? But because he said like the word, I don't remember what the wording was specifically, but he used a word that we need to fight them and storm, you know, their offices. But like, he wasn't saying literally, let's get guns and go storm. You know what I mean? But they made it, that's how they made it sound like. In fact, I listened to the clip. I had to listen to the clip because I watched Lester Holt of MSNBC, I think it was, talking to some horrible globalist on TV, and he was like, "Oh, weren't you frightened when you heard Alex Jones say this?" And the way he made it sound, like, I actually thought for a second, wait, did Alex Jones really say, "Let's go murder these people"? Because that's the way he, you know, that's what Lester Holt's making it sound like. And I had to go back and watch the clip, that, and it was so benign. They clearly twisted what he was trying to say in order to deplatform him. And so they're just looking for ways to take away our voices. So I thought, you know what? They're not burning books yet. Of course, this was before they literally, you know, got rid of Rush V's book, or Rush's books. I always say Rush V because that's his Twitter handle. But they took all of his books off of Amazon. So I used to think that, well, they're not burning books yet. And I guess they kind of are.
There's huge censorship, but I don't want to go into the censorship issue because I've gone into that with a lot of guests. So okay. Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. So, that's why I wrote the book. Cause I was like, that not only do we need to be able to talk about this topic, and fiction makes it safe to talk about this topic, but also because if you ever, we were just talking about how the left basically promotes their ideas through fiction. And, you know, people always say, "Oh, the left can't meme. The left can't meme." No, the left is really good at memeing. They're the best memers on the planet. They charge tickets to, you know, to pay, you have to pay money to see their memes. People line up, they spend the night waiting outside a theater to be the first to see their new meme. And in fact, a lot of the people on the right are paying money to watch these memes. So don't tell me the left can't meme. They're really good at it. The right sucks at fiction. Like, they suck at fiction, and maybe they don't suck at it. They just, that doesn't seem to be a priority. And I think part of that is the left brain, right brain kind of a thing. And I think that a lot of people on the right are left brain people and think more in terms of, I think you're going to have more engineers, for example, on the right, and you're going to have more artists on the left. And that's just because of the way our brains work. And so it makes sense. And it's also why it's so difficult to have very logical conversations with people on the left, because it's just, they're in emotion land. But unfortunately, if you want to make fiction or even powerful memes that are really going to affect normies on an emotional level, and that, you got to start thinking about stuff like that. Like, the rational argument is only going to work on rational people. And I think at this, we're at a point now where all the rational people are already on our side. So we need to keep making the rational argument, and it's going, and part of that's because it's going to evolve, but it's, you need to also make rhetorical arguments, and you also need to make emotional arguments, and you need to appeal to people that, quite frankly, aren't very reasonable, and they're not very logical, and they don't have critical thinking skills. But if you make them feel inspired by your cause, or if you use negative reinforcement, make them feel ashamed to not be part of your cause. I mean, that's one thing that I think would be really powerful, because that's what's controlling a lot of people on the left right now anyway, is you have a lot of people, I think, conforming out of fear of how they'll be ostracized by the left in the public space if they don't. Look at the apologies that, like, what was it? Kevin Hart is his name, or whatever. The guy that was going to do the that award show. I hate award shows, so I forget which one it was. Might have been the Oscars. But he said something, like, he made some jokes about gay people in 2010 or something like that. Someone dug up some really old tweets, and they're like, "Oh, he's homophobic. He can't possibly host a show now, because in 2010 he said some stuff about gays," and it wasn't even that bad, especially for 2010. It wasn't that bad. And
This is the stuff about the left going back and finding anything that they can object to. I mean, they're sort of purifying the public space so that there is just no interference from the right, or what they now define as the right. They're purifying the public space of everything that they object to, that they find non-conducive towards their social goals.
Well, and they do that through it used to be ridicule, right? Like I remember that you had like the Daily Show types, Jon Stewart, and they would use ridicule, like, oh, if you're on the right, you're a dumbass, ha ha, like series of tubes, listen to this senator, he doesn't know what the internet is. And you know, you'd have a lot of that kind of discourse, and it worked. It was really effective. You know, the Stephen Colbert Show, same thing. And then it kind of got really nasty in the last few years. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was because of Trump or if Trump was because of the change. I don't know. It's a chicken and the egg kind of a thing. But it went from we're gonna ridicule the right to we're going to threaten the right, and we're going to attack them physically, and we're going to try to, you know, get rid of any means they have to feed their families, and we're going to make it dangerous to be on the right. And it happened quick too. It wasn't like this was like a slow progression. It was like one day they were talking about how, you know, only really ignorant people went like multiculturalism to you're a Nazi and we should punch Nazis, you know, like in a weekend, like that happened. And, you know, it's just going to get worse. It's definitely going to get worse. I think
so. This is the black pill fact of the conversation.
Yeah. Then.
I mean,
yeah. Okay.
I'd rather not end on a bad note. So let's talk about the two most recent videos you did and what, I mean, I haven't watched them yet, so I don't want to be presumptuous, but would you say it's correct that they signal a new direction for your channel?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think so. I think, so the first, I mean, last two videos, the first one was, it was kind of an artsy thing. Like it was kind of, I didn't know like if it would go over well, to be honest. But I was kind of just playing around with animation and I was kind of pissed off. It's actually kind of about what I was just talking about, where I was upset that I knew it was going to get worse before it got better. But the reason it's going to get worse before it gets better is because people they have their Xboxes and they have their reality TV and they have their fast food and they have their cushy jobs or their lattes. They have their creature comforts. And unfortunately, you're going to have to deprive them of a lot of those creature comforts before they're going to want to. I mean, they won't even go out. Like, look at the French. They're not going to put on a yellow vest and go out and get pissed off about any of this stuff. Like, the French are, I was rather impressed, to be honest, with what they've been doing the last few weeks here. But for Americans to do that, you'd have to, man, like every Starbucks would have to, like, disappear, and then the satellite that provides the Kardashians or whatever show people are watching these days would have to like crash into the space station and shut off all their TV. it would have to be some cataclysmic event that would totally, but or the economic crash, you know, something. It would have to, but it has to be big, and it might even be so big as like people have trouble. I don't know. I actually kind of go back and forth on this because sometimes I feel like it has to be so big that people have trouble feeding their family. But then not that long ago, this was a few years ago, the city of Phoenix, like I guess Arizona gets all of their gasoline from like one pipeline, like for people's cars. And I guess the pipe broke. And so there just wasn't any gas in Phoenix. And Phoenix is pretty big. Maybe like at the time, I think it was like 5-6 million people there. And so 5-6 million people, not any gas. And within 3 days, people were hijacking gasoline trucks. And this is a fairly laid back part of the country. You know, like Phoenix isn't like Detroit, you know, Phoenix isn't even like New York, crime wise, I don't think it's all that bad. But that's how long it took. Was just we don't have gas. All right, we're gonna start, you know, turning into bandits after 2 or 3 days. So if you were to have an interruption of any kind of essential thing, obviously food would be the big one. But if you had any kind of interruption of food, electricity, water, anything like that, I think it would go to hell really fast. But as long as the trains keep running on time, everything's good. So I think that's why I was upset when I made that first video. So I kind of did a video where I was saying, what is it going to take for you to speak up? Like, what is it going to take for you to put the phone down? What is it going to take for you to stop playing Fortnite, to stop, you know, smoking your medical marijuana and listening to mumble rap or whatever, and actually join the fight and speak up and get pissed off, maybe put on a yellow vest and protest somewhere. And so that was kind of like the narrative of the first one. And it's, I don't want to say it's poetic, but it's kind of like a monologue, you know? And then the one I did after that was kind of like almost like a follow-up to that, where people were asking me, well, what do you want me to do? And first of all, I want to say to anyone listening to this, I'm not like a leader. Okay. So, I don't always have all the answers. I'm more of, like I said, I'm more of a storyteller and someone who has like I can spot trends in society and whatnot, but I'm usually not like, you know, I'm not someone who's going to be out there storming the gates. That might change. I've thought about maybe getting more into activism in 2019. That might be something I do. But for right now, I'm just like a guy who, sees what's going on and isn't happy about it. But people were asking me, like, you know, what they felt really helpless. And, you know, it's not that they didn't want to do something. They just felt like there was nothing they could do. And so, my last video was a study or a video about a study that Solomon Asch, did in the 1950s, where, he got a room full of people and, he told them, I'm going to show you some cards on it. And on the cards, there's going to be a series of lines on one side and then one line on the other side. And I want you to tell me which of the three lines on one side matches the length of the line on the other side. And I'm trying to gauge people's ability to perceive the length of lines. And it was actually a lie. Everyone in the room was an actor except for one person. And what he was going to do is, all the actors in the room were going to purposely pick the wrong match so that to see if they could basically peer pressure the real person into picking something wrong, even though it's right in front of him. Like it was pretty obvious. It wasn't like hard to tell. It was very obvious which lines, you know, were matched up. And they found that 37% of the people went along with the wrong answer. And which is pretty freaking scary, honestly, that 37% of the people are just, they see right in front of them the right answer, and they're either too afraid to say the right answer, or they're literally being hypnotized by the perceptions of others. The social input is overriding their visual input. And so he actually interviewed him afterwards and determined that was basically the three reasons were people, a small percentage literally thought that they had the right answer. And they were essentially hypnotized into thinking that they had the right answer because everyone around them was saying this other answer. Another group knew that it was wrong, but they didn't want to be the guy that had the only guy who didn't have the same answer as everybody else. And then there was another group that, they thought maybe they were right, but they defaulted their judgment to the group because they figure there's no way I'm right because all these other people have this other answer. So I'm going to use heuristics and let them be my thinking. So 37%, that's pretty big. And I talked about how a good example of this is how in the media, there's so many, you know, gay characters in movies and in television. It almost seems like there's, you know, at least a quarter of the population is gay. I mean, if you watch movies or television, that seem maybe in nowadays, it might even seem like half the population is gay and a quarter of it's trans, you know? And when the numbers are much lower. And Gallup did a study where they questioned Americans, what do you think the population or gay population is in America? And that's how they were answering. They in 2015, I think they were saying they thought the number was 25%, that they thought 25% of the population of America was gay. And, I mean, if you can imagine that. Yeah, no, they really thought that. And the real number is something like 3. And so that shows you how their perception has been screwed up by being surrounded by the media telling them, oh no, like really, like almost everyone's gay. And so that was the first part of the video. And then I was like, all right, so now that you understand that this is something that's going on, don't be blackpilled by that, because they did a variation of this study where they did the exact same thing. The only thing they changed was one other person would say the right answer. And when they had one other person say the right answer, the number dropped from 37% all the way down to 5%. And that's a tremendous change. And when they interviewed the people afterwards, they also found that these people would experience positive feelings and feel like they were like on a team with this other person that they had never met. Like they were like, yeah, we're the right ones and you guys are the wrong ones. And so in the video, I kind of just say, look, you might be afraid of speaking out because you don't want to lose your job or lose friends or whatever, but you might be surrounded by other people that if you're just that first one to break the ice and actually speak your mind and speak truth, who knows, you might find other people around you in your life that do agree with you, that are just afraid or programmed or whatever. And if everyone keeps their mouth shut and if everyone remains like the right is, you know, I hate this term, but it applies to the right. It seems like over generations, the silent majority thing is true. The right seems to like not want to make a lot of noise ever until they do. Well, and then it's
coming to the point. Yeah, it's coming to the point now where the right has to make some noise. I mean, obviously you could say that Brexit and Trump were examples of that happening, but it has to get much more shameless than that. I mean, with that, it was just, you go into a private ballot box and cast your vote. I think the right has to, right-wing people of all kinds need to become much less ashamed, because the left is expert at social shaming and they've been using it against us for decades. And at this point, they're so shrill and intolerant of any deviation from their program that if you give in to them, they will destroy your society. That's what they're doing.
Right. No. And in that study, when they would take someone away and the number would drop down to 5%, when they added someone that would agree with you and they would go down to 5%. If in that same scenario, halfway through the study, they took that person out of the room, the number went right back up to 37. As soon as they removed the person that was agreeing with, you know, the right answers, they went right back to conforming at the same level as everybody else. So if they censor us, that's what happens, is the conformity rate in the country goes right back to where it was.
Basically to end on a positive note, because this is for Christmas and all that. I mean, yeah. what can be established here is that it is essential to have as many voices speaking the truth as possible, because it has a huge knock-on psychological effect on everyone else.
Yeah, no, it is. And I've always thought that's why I do my channel, you know. There's things I could do and make a lot more money, not feel as nervous about my future and stuff. But I feel like it's something I have to do. I'd feel like if I didn't do it, I'd be a shitty person. Especially because I feel like I'm in a unique position where I have worked in film and in news, and I kind of understand it better than a lot of people. And so, you know, with great knowledge comes great responsibility or whatever. But so I feel like I have to do it. But I think, and not everyone has to start a YouTube channel, by the way, I'm not saying that, but you know, speak up at dinner and speak up at work. I mean, if you can, I understand you don't want to lose your job, but, you know, as much as you can speak out without putting yourself in, I guess, direct harm, I would do it. Because quite frankly, there's a phrase I want to say that really sums up, but it might be too much. So I'll put it this way. I would much rather someone unfriend me. I don't use Facebook anymore, but if I did, unfriend me on Facebook than have to, in a few years, have to do something else with that person or solve that problem another way. I would much rather that they're mad at me and they think I'm a jerk, you know, now, then I don't say anything, and then they're trying to put me in a camp in a few years. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
that's what you got to do. You got to speak out now, because as we've learned with Gavin, it doesn't matter if you know, if you try to play the game and you try to be really nice and say all the right things. Well, I mean, not that, you know, Gavin literally was putting things up his ass and doing stuff like that. I don't think is necessarily playing the game, but you know, in his more recent stuff, he was trying to play the game, and it was just being a conservative. Wasn't even being that outrageous. Although I will say, he also, in addition to, you know, his shenanigans, he also was way more vocal than anyone in the establishment is about Hillary Clinton being a literal murderer. You know, like he would bring it up. In fact, they used it in the CRTV ads that get played on YouTube. They used one of his bits talking about the Clinton body count, in their ad, which I thought was amazing. But you know, he wasn't so. I know a lot of people have been making fun of Gavin and for being deplatformed, which I think is a terrible thing, because I think he was. I liked him. I think he was good for what he. I understand the criticism, but I think he was. I think we don't need less voices on the right. We need more voices on the right. But as he learned, you know, if you even when you try to play the game, you're not safe, and you know. They're gonna go after Sargon, for Christ's sake.
Well, I mean, absolutely.
I get it. I mean, I wouldn't have done what he did. I mean, that was pretty. I mean, I would have thought that there'd be some repercussions. I mean, there's just some words you cannot say in 2018 without suffering some consequences, and I would have thought that would have been obvious to him. But all the same, it's Sargon, right? And it was on some obscure stream, and so who knows? But they're going after Sargon. Milo is sort of the same thing, quite frankly. Milo's not that extreme, and he belongs to some of the leftist protected classes, and they deplatformed him from Patreon because their official reason was because he was associated with the Proud Boys, which he's marginally, if at all, like, and I don't think it really at all. I think while they were kind of cool for a little bit, he went to one of their events and was like, you know, pro Proud Boy for like a day, you know, but it's not like he got the tattoo and, you know, was beating up Antifa with them. You know what I mean? Like, so it really doesn't matter. They'll just try to find an excuse to deplatform us one by one. I, you know, with that said, I do think it's important that we try to play the game to some extent, because we don't want to just all get deplatformed immediately. But, and we have to think about what's going to be persuasive to normies too. You know, we can't just be like, you know, I get so many comments in my YouTube videos where, people who clearly don't understand persuasion are demanding things from me.
Well, we can talk about that another time. I think that would be a good hangout in itself, actually, about ways of getting our message across that are more effective. Yeah, a nice focus hangout on that would be very useful, I think. But anyway, let's end it there, because I think this has been a good sort of sample of your worldview and what your concerns and your channel. But of course, it's important to say that your channel is very polished. I mean, this has been a sort of off the cuff chat. It's important to say that your videos are not like mine, actually. I mean, mine are improvised. Your videos are pre-scripted and very nicely edited. So they're quite a different thing.
Yeah, I'm not as good live. I'll be the first to admit that. I'm not as good.
I'm saying that.
I'm more of a writer than I am a talk show host. You know, I'm definitely think more. I have to write everything I do. Like all my videos, I spend a lot of time writing. That's the thing that takes the longest. I mean, you say the videos look very clean and edited, and that's just because I've been editing video for my entire life. I actually don't spend that much time on them. The thing I spend the most time on is just writing everything. Because I can talk, obviously I'm talking too much right now, but, when I have time to actually focus my thoughts, because I am very ADD, that's when I do my best work.
Okay. All right. Well, let's end it there. So that's, Devin Stack from Blackpilled, and, thanks very much for appearing on Millennial.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on, and let me know. Hopefully you can do this again next year, and I'd love to join.
Well, let's just hope so, eh? God knows what the situation will be. All right. Okay, so I'll be back very shortly with Electra from France. In the meantime, this is Blackpilled, so please go and have a look at his channel. It's got lots of good videos there. And bye-bye for now, and I'll see you soon.
Merry